I'm Andrew Schwartz, and you're listening to The Truth of the Matter, a podcast by CSIS where we break down the top policy issues of the day and talk with the people that can help us best understand what's really going on. To help us get to the truth of the matter about the future of the United States-UK Intelligence Alliance, we have with us CSIS's Jake Harrington. Jake, welcome to Truth of the Matter.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jake, you have this new report entitled The Future of the United States-United Kingdom Intelligence Alliance. Why do intelligence agencies collaborate, and for such a secretive business, that kind of seems counterintuitive?
Yeah, I mean, the story of intelligence relationships, alliances, collaboration goes back for the US and the UK 76 years now. It started in the wake of World War II, our common fight against Hitler and fascism. And over the course of 75 years, we built the strongest relationship in the history of the Western world from intelligence purposes. But the reason that intelligence agencies collaborate in the first place is, you know, if you look at just simple economics, it's comparative advantage. Some intelligence services, some countries have advantages that others don't. And that may be that they have certain technologies or certain geographical advantages or certain cultural relationships in areas that others don't. And so what some, you know, refer to this as is a barter economy. You know, you barter information for other information. And what it makes is it makes it easier for intelligence agencies to do more work than they could on their own.
So the US has the strongest relationship with the UK. What are some of the other, you know, countries that we do have? I mean, I know we do with Israel. I know we do with New Zealand, Canada. Who are our closest collaborators?
Yeah. So the history of the US-UK relationship goes back to an agreement signed in 1946 called YACUSA, which is the British-US Communications Intelligence Agreement. That was a landmark agreement that basically had the United States and the United Kingdom agree to share a wide range of really sensitive intelligence information.
And this is how it came to be the deepest in the world, is from this point on.
Exactly. And so over time, our closest allies decided that they wanted to be a part of this. And so that's what evolved into what's now known as the Five Eyes, which is the US, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And so what the Five Eyes is really a signals intelligence relationship between the services and those countries that conduct the communications intelligence mission, collecting communications, breaking codes, translating information.
That's what you mean by signals?
Yes, sir. So while they work, they're focused on that, but what has evolved is this culture of Five Eyes affinity in the intelligence space. It's built trust outside of that signals intelligence mission into other areas, including human operations, where you go into recruit an agent in a foreign government, and doing intelligence analysis, where you look at all of the information that's coming in from all of your different sources and assessing trends about where things are going and delivering that information to policymakers. And so the US and all of those Five Eyes partners have really close relationships across all of those missions. It started with the signals intelligence relationship, but it's really broadened and deepened over the last 75 years.
And I guess it's no coincidence that all of those countries are English-speaking countries.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the key things is we've
and
got
democracies,
right? Shared language, shared history, shared values in particular.
Are there any other countries that could be added to that Five Eyes grouping, like Ireland, Israel, or are they just very close but not as close?
You know, it's a very exclusive club, and it's built again around that history of trust. And so, you know, one of the things that's also it's about trust and enduring trust when we fail each other. And so what we've found over time is, you know, and particularly in the context of the US and the UK relationship, it's not just the strengths and the successes it's had over 75 years, it's its ability to withstand tremendous shock. So, you know, earlier in the Cold War, there was an event called the Cambridge Five, where a series of British intelligence officers turned out to be spying for the USSR. We continue to maintain the relationship. It didn't break. The disclosures from Edward Snowden about US, UK, and allied communications intelligence operations, the same that we've maintained that relationship despite those setbacks along the way.
So, Jake, we've seen the Biden administration talk a lot about prioritizing alliances, and this theme of international cooperation has been a prominent feature of both the US and UK national security strategies and guidance. If this is the case, what can they do to improve?
Yeah. And so we've talked a lot about why alliances work so well, why they're so important. But, you know, we've been working on this project for about a year now. So we started it right after the 75th anniversary of the Yakuza agreement. And over the course of the last year, all we've seen is additional announcements reinforcing the strength of this relationship. We have a new Atlantic Charter. We have the AUKUS agreement. And we have really unified response to the issues that are going on in Ukraine. So what we found is that in all of these documents, we've reinforced our commitment and recommitted ourselves to the special relationship. But as we undertook our analysis over the last 2 months, talking to dozens of people in the United States, in the United Kingdom, current, former officials and people in academia and the technology industry, what we basically have found is that the relationship, as all things over time need, is sort of an engine tune-up. There's all of sorts of inefficiencies baked into the relationship that make it really hard for the people on the ground implementing the special relationship on a day-to-day basis to meet the expectations that are laid out in that guidance and strategy. And so that's why we've come up with 6 recommendations across 3 pillars to make it easier for us to work together to achieve what we have agreed to do easier than it has been in the past.
Jake, obviously these past several weeks, you know, we've been witnessing Russia's, you know, war with Ukraine, their invasion of Ukraine. This has made it more apparent that Russia poses a direct threat to Europe and to the United States' interests. Why is this report that you've done so important in that context?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've seen remarkable unity across the alliance between the US, the UK, NATO, Europe. We've seen in particular the importance of intelligence in this area. You know, one of the quotes that we reference in the report came from Richard Moore, who's the current director of MI6. And last year in a speech, he said, you know, for MI6 to remain secret, it has to become more open. And so that is a lot to take on, because what we're thinking about is a world where intelligence agencies need to be able to communicate with the public. They need to be able to communicate with each other. And so we've taken that as sort of the way that we've moved forward with this report, looking at, you know, the US and the UK declassifying intelligence in advance of the Russian invasion, seeking to confront Putin in the information space. That's a really significant development, and it shows that unity of working between allies in the intelligence space to work together against common threats.
Jake, one of the things that stands out from your report is this idea of making intelligence work for democracy. What do you mean by that, and why is that important today?
Yeah, so the report really focuses on 2 things. One is this sort of, you know, as I refer to, this engine tune-up for the alliance, making it easier for us to share information, to exploit information, and looking at new different types of technologies that could enable it in the future. But more broadly, I mean, again, getting back to what our strategic guidance says, the, you know, democracy is under attack is the quote in some of the guidance. And what it is that's not necessarily an intelligence challenge to defend democracy, but intelligence agencies have a key role to play in speaking up for what it is that they stand for, how you can conduct security and intelligence activities in a free and open society. And so what this really boils down to is this idea around technology and how we've seen countries like China and Russia weaponize technology to suppress freedom of speech, suppress legitimate political opposition. And we've seen a tremendous amount of detail in the ways that China has used bulk data collection, bulk data analytics to target its citizens. Where the role for Western intelligence services is to come out and basically make the case for why, you know, you can have your cake and eat it too with technology in the security environment. That there are ways that you can both harness the opportunities delivered by emerging technology and data to conduct operations, but to do so in a way that respects human rights, respects privacy, respects civil liberties, and that overall there are core pillars and components of how you should be doing intelligence operations in an open society.
Jake, you have 6 recommendations in this report that are divided under 3 pillars. Can you talk about those pillars and what you envision these recommendations to be?
We've divided them down across 3 pillars, as you mentioned, and it's really about, all of this is about being more open with each other, being more open with our allies as we do this secret work. So basically, you know, the overarching piece is that we need to modernize the way we share information. And so a lot of the information sharing policies that are in effect for the United States in particular are dated. They're written in an age before the bulk data challenges that we face today. And these are about making it possible for us to share data securely at scale with close allies and implementing more tiered risk management frameworks into the way that we think about the risk of sharing information with the opportunities. The second one is having the technology to be able to use this data, make sense of it, to ingest it. And that means building technology together. And so we've looked at the Department of Defense as a really good model for this, as they've built new software factories, they're called, across the services that make it really easy for teams to identify a challenge, develop software that addresses that challenge, deploy it quickly, and ensure it's done in a way that's secure. There's a lot of lessons that could be learned for the US and the UK to pioneer together so that they could build software jointly in the same types of ways, so that when a US and a UK intelligence team are trying to work together on a joint data challenge, they can quickly build the capabilities that they need to work on that. That's very challenging in this environment. There's a lot of restrictions over the way we buy technology, we secure technology, particularly with whenever there's a foreign nexus with that. And so what we're urging the US government to do in particular and work with their allies is to look at what the current restrictions are on the ways that we cooperate with foreign software developers, foreign development teams, so that we can think about new ways to tier risk. Because if we get back to AUKUS for a second, one of the core components of that, beyond working with the Australians to develop nuclear submarines, is this focus on joint integration of advanced technology. And that includes areas including quantum computing, artificial intelligence, cyber capabilities, and working together and integrating our industrial bases to do this. The current restrictions on the way that we share technology, jointly invest in technology, make that a very difficult goal to achieve under current regulations. And so what we're encouraging the government to do is look at new ways to do that, particularly with AUKUS as the hook, because we're not going to be able to achieve what we've set out to do if we don't look at how that's actually going to be implemented on the ground.
So what are some of the key things, though, that the US needs from the UK and vice versa?
Yeah, I mean, so at the end of the day is that we both have very vibrant startup environments. Yeah. So when we look back at Richard Moore's comments, he wasn't just talking about being open with the governments, with each other as an allies, or being open with the public, but also with the technology industry. We need to embrace them as partners. The days of governments as the leading investors in research and development for technology, they're long gone, they're decades gone. And where we are now is an environment where there are tremendous capabilities being developed both in the United States and the United Kingdom from a technology perspective that potentially have really important intelligence applications. I mean, that's our strength, is the innovation in our industrial bases and our academic institutions that are looking at things like artificial intelligence, high-powered computing, new and emerging ways of clean energy, as well as quantum computing.
So take a situation like Ukraine right now. England's no longer part of the EU, but of course they're part of Europe, you know, in the continental sense, and they're part of NATO. So what does the US and UK do when it comes to such a conflict? How do they work together?
You know, my focus is on the intelligence aspect of it. But, you know, again, it's we talked a little bit earlier about why intelligence agencies collaborate in the first place. And again, it's back to comparative advantage. The scope of the threats that we face today are too much for any single country, single service, single analyst to handle on their own. And so there's several different models that you can look at, and they all have connection to here. One is that, you know, maybe we have unique insights from certain collection assets that we have and certain collection assets that they have. If we can share that information and we can jointly analyze it and compare notes, that makes us stronger because we have the opportunity to leverage that scale that we both have, both looking at the same data. You know, there's also this idea that we divide and conquer. The world is big, it's complex, there's too much data. So there are certain areas we say, look, you know, within the context of this alliance, you focus over here and I'll focus over here. And then once we're done with our independent work, we'll come back and share what we learned.
Jake, this is a fascinating report and one that I think will be instructive for years to come. Thank you for coming on Truth of the Matter to help us get to the bottom of it.
Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this podcast, check out our larger suite of CSIS podcasts, from Into Africa, The Asia Chessboard, China Power, AIDS 2020, The Trade Guys, Smart Women, Smart Power, and more. You can listen to them all on major streaming platforms like iTunes and Spotify. Visit csis.org/podcasts to see our full catalog